You're listening to The Stack, first broadcast on the 20th of April 2013 on Monocle 24.
A man who redesigned the News Weekly, an editor with a mission to redefine women's publishing, and a pile of print editions, both old and new. This is edition 34 of The Stack. This is The Stack from Studio One here in Midori House. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we ask how you reinvent a weekly news title with bold design and creative flair.
When not having enough time to think things through, you tend to take more risks. And what's funny about those risks is they tend to pay off. And those little victories that you have on the hoof and kind of not really kind of thinking too much about something and just being very instinctive about the covers is, I think, one of the reasons that we've been quite successful.
That was Richard Turley, creative director of Bloomberg Businessweek. We'll also look at the challenges facing brand new titles hitting the newsstands when we interview the editor of Libertine.
Actually, the consideration was whether to do print or not at all. And I think in the end, we thought, yes, it is important because it's a luxury product and it is something very desirable. And we want to create that kind of sit-back experience and people can spend hours with it.
All that and a few more reading tips today on edition 34 of The Stack, live from Studio One in London. Hello and welcome to edition 34 of The Stack, Monocle 24's weekly focus on the print industry. I'm Andrew Tuck. Each Saturday, we're joined by editors and photographers, correspondents and creatives to review the best in established weeklies and new titles. And today is no exception. Editor-in-chief Tyler Brulé is currently sipping on a sake in Tokyo, so I'll be your host for the next hour. Let's meet our guests. Our first guest is Richard Turley, the creative director of Bloomberg Businessweek. After starting his career at The Guardian in London and following a competition victory that offered him a work experience placement, Richard later became art director of G2 before moving to New York to work on Businessweek and what has been described as the magazine's creative comeback. Welcome to Midori House, Richard.
Thank you.
Good billing there, but I must say that of all the art directors around the moment, you have a really fascinating job because... yes, lots of art directors have become famous doing fashion titles, but actually your name has kind of risen up in the firmament in the news arena, which is very rare. And you'd probably have to go back to kind of maybe the 60s or the 70s or the 80s, the very last time that somebody really had kind of made this mark. What do you think has allowed you to become, let's be honest, a little bit of a star of the front cover?
Well, that's very flattering. I'm not quite sure. I think I've got a very good editor. I think that that's kind of fundamentally important to any magazine. And we sit as close as we're sitting now, and we talk all the time. And I think he'd probably agree that we're friends, and we have, and that relationship is very important. And there's a lot of trust in the relationship. And so kind of primarily at Business Week, I suppose that's kind of really what I put it down to. But also kind of a sense of kind of autonomy and freedom within that kind of role. And we're sort of left our own devices, in many ways, or have been. So I think that that trust has been very important, which has kind of come down through the company, and they've let us just kind of get on with it.
Because what's fascinating is when you're on a news cycle, you can't quite kind of plan out the next 6 months' covers. It's not like you can have all these ideas stored up. Are you working really on a week-to-week basis, or do you often know, actually, I bet he's going to do a cover on this, I will warm up that little idea and keep it in the cupboard for when I need it?
There have been a couple of times where I've kind of had an idea which I thought, okay, we'll do that as a cover. But actually, I find the lack of time, the lack of kind of, that you haven't really got enough time to kind of to fully think through an idea. The kind of the most, probably one of the reasons for our success to a certain extent, because we're not allowed the opportunity to overthink things. I think a lot of our covers, actually in a funny sort of way, don't really work. They don't really kind of, sometimes they're kind of a bit off message. Sometimes they don't kind of have the kind of the consistencies that the stories within do. But that tends to be because I don't have a story to work with. And so, it has been forever thus with me, because with at G2 as well. So I'm very used to kind of working kind of blindsided and just sort of, kind of slightly independent of the kind of the flow of the magazine in a way with the covers. And so, as I said, I mean, by kind of crunching time, by not having enough time to think things through, you tend to take more risks. And what's funny about those risks is they tend to pay off, and they have done in my case, and in a Business Week's case, and those little victories that you have on the hoof and kind of not really kind of thinking too much about something and just being very instinctive about the covers, is I think one of the reasons that we've been kind of quite successful. You say we work on a month to month basis. We work based on an hour to hour basis many times. We chop and change covers very quickly. I mean, I'm kind of over here at the moment, but I've been kind of emailing Josh about kind of what the cover is going to be tomorrow, which kind of ships sort of, well, I don't know what time it is over there now. But, we still don't really know what's on the cover. And so we kind of, and that is the sort of, I don't know if we kind of necessarily impose those limitations on ourselves, but we kind of, we work to those limitations. And I think that, in a funny sort of way, gives us quite a lot of freedom to sort of to not care too much. But that sounds bad.
No, there's I'm going to quiz you lots about this. But before we meet our next guest, can you just tell me, traditionally in the US market, there's been an impression that the cover doesn't really count that much because most people in the US actually buy their magazines on subscription. But whether that's true or not, you don't seem to take that on board. There's something almost, and I know that your art direction goes way beyond the cover, but there's something about those covers that reminds me of the discipline of somebody doing an LP cover maybe 20 years ago or something. There's something very statement about them. And why is that it matters so much, that cover these days?
Well, I would kind of extrapolate that out from just thinking about what is a cover, now in the kind of the digital world, if you like, the kind of the publishing industry that we work in. I mean, for me now it's an advert. I mean, it has forever been an advert, but traditionally it's an advert to sell a bunch of pages. Now I think the cover is something that kind of is a statement of where you are in the week. And it is hopefully in its best incarnations a sort of an advert for your journalism, wherever it is, whether it's on the kind of it's on a website, on an iPad or whatever. It's a big advert, but not just an advert to sell pages. So it's kind of your defining, well, it has become anyway now a kind of our defining moment of the week where we kind of we set this thing out and it is kind of, and it kind of generates a degree of kind of excitement about the issue coming up. For even if people don't buy the magazine, I think there's lots of people who kind of follow a magazine who've never bought it, but through the covers, there is a sort of, that it's a sort of form of advertising for everything that we do.
Well, anyone who's looked at any magazine awards over the last year will certainly have seen one or two of your covers. you've probably got quite a nice bit of brassware and goldware on your desk these days. Good paperweights, anyway. Now, our second guest is Debbie Evans, editor of a brand new title, Libertine. Libertine is a multi-platform lifestyle brand that hopes to redefine the women's media landscape by celebrating inner life over outer appearance. And the first issue was out last week. Debbie, welcome. That's quite a billing as well. That's kind of rewriting the whole of women's history and the whole of the newsstand, yeah. with one title. We like to give our guests good billing here. Now, explain to me, that part of the newsstand is packed. It's kind of full of so many titles. What made you think, actually, there is still, even now today, a gap here that I want to produce a title for?
I think it has a lot to do with the fact that actually my experience has not always been in print publishing. And I think it actually takes someone out from outside the industry to be able to spot a gap like that, because I don't think this could have come from inside the industry. However, I've had the idea for about 8 years, and every single person I've ever spoken to about women's magazines, because there's nothing I identified with on the newsstand. I was reading, well, I've got magazines here, Monocle, Port. Actually, a lot of them were kind of quite masculine titles. And to me, women's interest has always been asynchronous with fashion and with style and those kind of superficial pursuits. But I think there's an implied assumption that all of the more serious stuff is actually aimed at men, even though it's not said. But that was certainly the impression of the women I was speaking to. And I realised actually it was probably more people than me that felt the same way, and I should do something about it.
So it's very, very difficult, and we all know, setting up a magazine and getting it out and distributing it. So where did you begin with? Is this a magazine that has a wealthy backer, or did you have to go out and raise funding? Is this your own house up on mortgage? How did you begin that process? Because it is a brave leap to go into print. Where did that little bit of the journey begin?
Well, I should probably first of all say that I definitely see this as a lot more than print, but I'm sure we'll get onto that. But in terms of backing it, actually, it was mostly my savings. I'm actively seeking investment because it's a very ambitious plan and I will need a lot more to make it all happen.
And the initial print run and the initial distribution is UK?
Is UK.
And how many?
At the moment. It's very, very small. We're deliberately doing kind of limited edition print. And then we're launching the iPad. So we've only got 1,500 for the first issue, which is very small deliberately. I think we might bump it up by 1,000 for the next one, but I don't think we'll go beyond that really, because I think it's nice to keep the luxury kind of rarity of the print product.
And there's lots I want to quiz you about, but give me an example of a story in the launch issue that you feel you wouldn't have found perhaps in other titles as you kind of scanned the, you know, the newsstand. Is there something you particularly, you know, feel defines your brand in a little
Certainly.
Way?
Certainly. Well, my background is a lot in, I love tech and I've written about tech a lot. So it was very important to me to have a lot of tech and science content in there. So there's an interview with a woman called Katia Shitova, who is the chief technical officer of a company called Yesarian Lives. They want to be an alternative to Google. They're a new search engine. We've actually not got any fashion in there or any beauty. The closest we get to product is kind of fountain pens and spectacles. So, yeah, those are two big differences.
Good. Well, those are huge differences for any women's title, any title indeed. So we'll pick your brains a little bit more and look inside the cover of Libertine in a moment. But that's Debbie Evans, who's one of our guests here today on The Stack, who has a new magazine out called Libertine. And we're also speaking to Richard Turley, who's the creative director for Bloomberg Businessweek. We'll be back in a moment. Like many of the editors we've spoken to on The Stack, Marcus Fares says he loves print. But what sets him apart is that he means it in a slightly different way. PrintShift, the magazine Marcus edits, is all about the burgeoning world of 3D printing. It explores its potential in everything from art to industry. Monocle's Tom Edwards asked Marcus about his new magazine and what sparked his passion for 3D printing.
10 years ago, in 2003, I went to the Milan Furniture Fair. And I met a group of designers called Freedom of Creation who presented a series of lights that were 3D printed. And I'd never been aware of 3D printing before. But these objects were so beautiful. They were so geometrically complex. Some of them were sort of complex geometries. Some of them were sort of flower-like forms. And I was really amazed both by the beauty of these pieces and also by the technology that made them. And the guy, Janne Kattanen, who designed them, was saying, this technology is going to change the world. Well, it didn't. But now, 10 years later, as a journalist, I've never experienced such a sudden rush of interest in a particular technology as 3D printing is going through right now.
And, I mean, when you look at the way that this technology is covered in other mediums, you know, things like Wired and so forth, I mean, what do you think? I mean, do you think that that has been a part of the uptake as well, that media outlets and in some ways your magazine is bringing it to the world and making it seem more accessible?
Yes, we've noticed, and we're an architecture and design magazine on the internet, and we've traditionally written about buildings and chairs and, you know, sometimes mobile phones, but mostly sort of inanimate objects. But we've noticed our readers are really, really interested in technology all of a sudden. And it feels like technologies like 3D printing are being pulled away from the geeks that sort of made them happen and towards the mainstream. So what we've done with this magazine, which is about 3D printing, which is called PrintShift, is to try and make it look accessible to everyone so people can understand the technology, which is quite hard to explain the mechanics of how 3D printing works. But when you see that now you can print dresses, sunglasses, so there's really no sector that is remaining untouched by this technology.
Were you worried when you were putting this magazine together that it was quite niche? I mean, it is quite a specific focus to have.
No, we weren't worried about that at all, really, because the backstory to why we've done a print magazine is we got together with Blurb. Blurb.com are a print-on-demand company, and they're kind of revolutionising the way that 2D things are printed, i.e. books and magazines. And we decided it would be a great opportunity for us to get together and do a product with them. And we liked the synergy between a print-on-demand magazine, i.e. a magazine that only exists when you press, purchase, and then the plant the printing factory prints one copy.
Let's talk about that actually, because that is something else that sets your magazine apart. So this isn't the kind of magazine that you pick up at a newsstand. It's not the kind of magazine that hangs around in you know stockrooms behind newsagents. It's fully on demand. So can you explain exactly how that mechanism works?
Okay, yeah. So I started out as a print journalist and then discovered the internet and moved online. People still like paper. People still like to pick something up, flick through the pages. They like the feel, the smell, the fact that they can sling it in the back of the car or shove it in their handbag and take it on the plane. But of course, the economics of printing magazines and books is really difficult, because you have to order tens of thousands of copies and then warehouse them somewhere and then hope that there's a distribution network that will get that book or magazine in the right shelves in front of the right customers. And of course, the internet's been exploited for buying things for a long, long time, but you've still traditionally had things sitting in warehouses. But print on demand means that there is no inventory until a customer buys it. So with this magazine, it's a 60-page magazine. It's sort of A4 format, and there aren't any of them until you buy it on blurb.co.uk's site, and then a very sophisticated print press in Eindhoven will print one copy for you.
That doesn't compromise the quality at all either. I mean, it looks like an amazing, really well put together magazine. So how does the business of that work? I mean, I imagine that Blurb, they obviously have take a cut of that, and how does the timing of it work? How long does it take to get the magazine once you've clicked on the button?
It takes about a week. So the genius of the print process is the software that runs the process, because of course traditional printing, you put one magazine through on a Tuesday morning, you do 10,000 copies, then they stop the presses, they change the paper, put another magazine through, and you if you miss your print slot, you're in trouble. But what Blurb's presses do is they manage multiple orders from all over the world. Some people printing, photographers printing books about their work, people who've just got married printing little brochures with all the photographs in it, and they all go through one after the other. So if you watch the press, there'll be a photographer's book going through, then there'll be someone's wedding pictures, then there'll be sort of a travel publication going through, then there'll be a brochure for a company that's put through a last minute order to go to a trade fair or something. And then there'll be like an amazing fashion book going through.
So rather than a traditional press where you just see the same page going over and over and over again.
Yeah, it changes. And then so all on one roll of paper, and then it's all chopped up, and there's barcodes on, very small barcodes on the pages. So these little robot dollies then take the pages into the right bit of the factory where they get bound in whatever cover paper they want, or hardback or softback or whatever.
Sure. And this is a pretty burgeoning technology and way of doing things in the magazine world. Is anyone else doing this? I mean, does that make you nervous at all that this is, a new thing? Or
no, this was an experiment. There is the potential for an advertising model to work in print on demand. There is. I mean, if you're printing hundreds of different magazines by hundreds of different micro publishers, then somebody could come along and sell advertising into that. But we've stayed away from it for this, because it's the first one. It does, at least I think, open people's eyes to how print could change, how we could still produce magazines that are as beautiful and well written as magazines of the past, but without the kind of complex scale and of investment that's required.
And I imagine as well, one of the other advantages would be that you could monitor your circulation much more closely and have a lot more control over that as far as the data goes. Is that true as well?
Oh, yes. You'll know where every single copy is going. But also you can change the magazine. So, like 3D printing is kind of an unlikely thing to write about in a magazine, because it changes so fast. But if one of our features was to go out of date, we could just put a new feature in the InDesign file, re-upload it, and it would carry on selling as before.
That was Marcus Fares, editor of PrintShift, discussing 3D printing with Tom Edwards. And you're listening to The Stack.
Years of scouring the globe for the world's best baristas means Monocle knows what makes a good cafe, which is why we're making a great one, just a stone's throw away from our London headquarters. Tucked away between neighbourhood shops on Chilton Street and Marylebone, Pop in to the Monocle Cafe for freshly baked pastries, simple delicious lunches, or a delectable dessert, all served alongside artfully made coffee, naturally. Have your cake and eat it, in or out, at London's new Monocle Cafe on Chiltern Street.
You're listening to The Stack with me, Andrew Tuck, and also with my two guests, Richard Turley of Bloomberg Businessweek and Debbie Evans of Libertine. Richard, we'll pick up with you first of all. This idea, you know, I know that Debbie wants to talk about this as well, being a multi-platform title, you know, I guess Monocle is as well. I always find that it's a bit of a cumbersome word, multi-platform, but I guess it means that you do more things these days than just put out a print title. Now, you do have a kind of a website and you have other kind of ways of sending out your message. So as a designer, are you having to kind of encompass all of those things, or are you dependent on a web team to kind of translate your ideas? You know, how astute are you at kind of covering every base?
Very, very unastute. I actually don't have to do any of that stuff. I mean, My limitations, if you like, as my job at Business Week are just the magazine, really. I mean, we're starting to kind of to integrate a little bit more with the website. Actually, the how-to issue that was launched this week is the first time, I think, really on the website. And there are certain parts of the website that we've kind of got a little bit of our kind of visual vocabulary, and you know, on the website. But generally speaking, you know, I was involved when the iPad app was kind of launched. But really, I mean, I'm not a digital, you know, I'm not a digital. Digital design to me feels like architecture, and I've never been interested in architecture. I've kind of, you know, I like, you know, I'm art, you know, I like kind of, you know, the emotional kind of side of kind of trying to kind of, you know, of ideas. So I've never really kind of felt a big yearning to, which is probably a huge strategic error in my career. Cause, you know, but you know, I don't know. I mean, I think in the future we'll be doing more stuff, and I hope to be doing. I mean, I do actually. I get more excited by films and you know, to interactive things operating their website.
But are you a believer? You know, which I think is a kind of a Monocle thing as well. That, you know, yes, if people can do other things, if that's their natural ability, okay. But you can't force people to do 20 different things. Actually, some people, they have a real skill, and they should be allowed to indulge in that.
We don't really articulate it in that way, but yeah, I mean that could be one way of kind of thinking about the way we work. Another thing, you know, I'm quite pleased in a way that I don't have any other responsibilities in that respect, because, and I think the people that I work with are probably the same too. I mean, one of the big kind of issues, if you like, with designers in the moment, particularly kind of, well, actually probably both sides of the Atlantic, is that, you know, when they finish doing a magazine, they have to kind of then spend the next 2 weeks doing the website, doing the iPad out, and putting all the fancy bits and the kind of the gizmos in, and you don't have that time to kind of think and kind of and consider what the next issue is going to be, and you kind of lose the thinking time. I mean, even though our kind of thinking time is very truncated, I mean, we basically do the magazine in 3 days, and then we think for 2 days, you know, and I think, you know, if we had to kind of do the iPad app, if we had to kind of do all these nuts, you know, do this other kind of stuff on the internet and on iPad, then we wouldn't have that time. And I would definitely think the print product would be lesser. And I think, you know, I think you can see that in kind of in some of the larger magazines, that, you know, they're not very good anymore, really.
No.
You know, and I wonder if that a part of that is because they're having to kind of diversify, and they're having to kind of chop and change and sort of do sort of three or four different things at once.
It's an argument we often hear here, because, you know, on this program, because I think, you know, what happens, things aren't as good because people, there's this kind of doomsday scenario. Everyone kind of believes that their print is going to die, so they don't invest in print. They all the clever kids in school get pushed onto the web projects, and the kind of print is allowed to flounder a little bit.
Well, and I think we've just become so obsessed. I kind of think about it as like the kind of the fall of the Roman Empire, really. You know, there's just this obsession of kind of something is going to have some this kind of doomsday scenario, and we've become so caught up in it that you know, we're forgetting the one thing that we can actually do, which is produce great magazines and really kind of concentrate on what you know, on, you know, we can't kind of predict what's going to happen in 5 years' time. We can plan for it, we can strategize for it, but it's not something that we can, you know, if we may, you know, I have a real belief that if we really sat down and tried to make really good magazines, people might actually buy them, you know, rather than kind of trying to think of all the different kind of media that you have to kind of be involved in, all the different kind of bits of this, the digital world, which now kind of suck you in. I mean, if you just concentrate on making a really great magazine, I think people would want to buy. I still think there's an appetite for magazines.
I think we agree with you. now, Debbie, it is important, though, to kind of, you know, Bloomberg Business Week does have a website. We have a website. We do film. You know, we have a, you're on a radio station that you can listen to on the internet. These things are important for brands. How did you, yeah, and you do have a tech background as well. So how important was this when you started the magazine to think about what you wanted your representation to be online, or did you want to have an iPad version straight away? How did you balance those things?
Yes, I mean, straight away, actually the consideration was whether to do print or not at all. And I think in the end we thought, yes, it is important because it's a luxury product and it is something very desirable, and we want to create that kind of sit back experience and people can spend hours with it kind of switched off, because increasingly obviously there's a desire to switch off, I think, sometimes. Having said that, I think it's important to consider exactly what the iPad version and the web equivalent of the content is going to be like at the same time as you're planning the print, so that you can have that link between them across all of the platforms at the same time. And I confess, we didn't spend enough time doing that on the first version because I underestimated how long it would take to pull together the print products, you know, in the best
quality.
So
did you almost start from a digital perspective?
Yes.
And then the print came second?
Absolutely.
So in some sense, are you happier with your representation as a... Do you have an iPad version and a website already?
The iPad version is pending Apple approval. We're kind of in those final stages of iTunes Connect at the moment. And the site is, again, early stages. I think I still need to work on the strategy for that. But, you know, we see it as the site is the snackable stuff that you maybe look at on your phone. The iPad, you spend a lot of time with. We actually haven't put much video or multimedia stuff in the iPad app because I don't really like that in iPad apps.
This is the bit I always get fascinated by. You know, so how are you kind of setting up yourself as a business? Are you giving, you know, is it the iPad version the same price as the magazine version? And also, just out of interest, when you've gone to see your initial round of advertisers, I still find this really difficult to find the advertiser who is willing to pay for digital what they're willing to pay for in print. That's a complicated thing when you're starting magazines.
It
how
is.
Have you balanced all that?
It is. I mean, I think what would be nice is, I think it's just a much simpler sell if you sell across all the platforms at the same time. And then you work out a way of making that brand work. There is a set of brands I think are very good for Libertine, but I think I have to be very careful, because if we're going to keep the quality and the authenticity and the kind of... Because there is a very strong value behind what we're doing, and I think it would be very difficult to uphold if we're pushed into working with some brands who might feel that they want certain types of models or certain types of content in the editorial. So I would like to get to a stage where we can work with really great brands that we feel an affinity with, but we don't have to kind of compromise who we are to work with the brands. So we have to try and think of other ways of doing it.
Okay, with both of you, I've got a long list of questions building up. But first, let's draw breath. You're listening to The Stack with me, Andrew Tuck. And my guests today are Debbie Evans, the editor of the new magazine Libertine, and Richard Turley from Bloomberg Businessweek. Richard, maybe we could actually pick, you've brought in a nice pile of magazines, perhaps we could pull a title out of there that's something you have a comment on, whether you like or don't like, or what would you like to start with?
Well, what I did is, because kind of panically ran around the corner to a newsagent, but I was quite impressed that you have a... It was a good newsagent.
Yeah, there's a good newsagent.
And I know there were things here that I hadn't...
And panic buying is quite good because...
That's how I buy.
But it's an immediate snapshot of the newsstand. You realise what's grabbed your attention.
Yeah. Well, I was kind of coming in thinking we'd have to do this very virtually, and I'd have to say, well, you know, I really like Purple Magazine. That's probably my favourite magazine. But, you know, I haven't got a copy here, but, you know, there it was around the corner, so I now have two copies of Purple Magazine.
Okay.
I think that is the one magazine that I will not buy, you know, that I have to kind of get very quickly. I picked up this thing, I can't even pronounce the title.
La Familia.
That one.
Yes.
Yeah. I picked up Private Eye. I miss this. They really, really miss this in America. And, you know, the fact that they very
now,
deliberately
this
don't
is,
do
this
a
is
digital project.
The Private Eye issue for Margaret Thatcher. And it's a souvenir issue. And it just says, Maggie, 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 out now.
I didn't even really look at the cover. I just saw Private Eye and had to hold okay. it again because I haven't held one of these for a little while. But yes,
I hope people aren't doing that with Bloomberg Business Week. I hope they're looking at your covers.
Well, I mean, maybe. You know, I don't know. I've always loved Private Eye. Dazed and Confused. I actually think Dazed and Confused has got better. I mean, it got very fashiony and now it's becoming a bit more kind of culturally. So I like Dazed and Confused. I picked up I Love You, which is a great sort of photography magazine.
We'll dive into one or two of them in a bit more depth. But first of all, what's interesting is you've picked up a pile of fashion magazines.
Yep.
And is that because you feel that's where the strength of art direction is at the moment?
I don't know. I think I've just always gravitated towards the sort of the small kind of artsy end of the kind of the magazine spectrum, I suppose. I mean, I don't particularly, as you can probably tell, I'm not a particularly fashion conscious, but I think that the type of design that they do and the type of magazines they produce are the ones that I kind of gravitate towards.
So when the phone rings and you answer and there's someone from Condé Nast and they're saying, actually, we have a new Vogue launching.
That's never going to happen.
But if it did, do you think that your skills are as transferable? You know, you've come up through a news heritage, but do you think actually, seeing what's on your desk, you'd be just as happy to sit down with, you know, a glossy magazine and a world of fashion, and that you could interpret that in the same way?
No, because I think I think fashion is a horrible, horrible industry to work in, from what I can gather. And you know, I'm very glad that my only exposure to it is through kind of glossy magazines. So I have kind of no desire to sort of to tread into that deeply screwed up world. So
because Wall Street is all kind of cuddly and friendly, isn't it?
Well, it's just I don't know. I mean, the sort of magazine that I do is kind of quite scrappy and quite unpolished, and it's sort of Dazed is actually kind of quite scrappy as well, but kind of there's not I don't really kind of, you know, there's no kind of big sense of kind of, and there's I kind of do craft, but kind of, you know, that whole idea of kind of, I don't know, fashion is just kind of really messed up, isn't it? I can't really articulate
you
on
that. I think Debbie agrees with you on that. Now, Debbie, what did you pick up? I presume you're going to have a big pile of business and financial titles go against Richard.
I bought two more serious titles. I brought Port, which is this quite an old issue, but I think it's just one of the best magazines out there. I think the quality of the content is incredible, and it's got a real warmth to it. And the fiction, and I love the kind of the way they put poetry in, just kind of like these little surprises on each page, and everything about it is lovely. But I also brought in a magazine called Herself, which is the complete opposite of Libertine. It is a fashion magazine, but it's entirely illustrated, which is what I like about it. So it's pure fantasy. I'm just showing some pages now.
It's almost like an art project. That
it is.
Tell me, did you ever look at, because The Gentlewoman perhaps is slightly in your territory of what you're trying to achieve. I guess that they are also trying to raise the bar on what they expect women want to read about. And they do beauty, but they do it in a kind of a way that isn't like all the other fashion magazines. And they've found success in a nice, robust, big niche way.
Absolutely. And I think they do fashion incredibly well and the writing is brilliant, but it is still a fashion magazine, I think. I feel when I read it, I think it's great, but it does still primarily deal with fashion.
I think I've got a nice copy of the gentlewoman here with Beyonce on the cover.
Oh, yes.
I'm throwing many magazines on the floor, if anyone can hear the sound of magazines falling on the floor. But again, interesting magazine, I guess, because it does kind of raise the bar of what the intelligence is, expectations of your audience.
Absolutely.
Can I ask you, for both of your magazines, when you're doing covers, when you're creating the content, you know, how it looks inside, Richard, do you presume that people are very smart, or do you presume that people are short attention span and they need to be just grabbed like that? How do you imagine someone sees your magazine when they see it on the newsstand?
Probably the latter. Probably that, you know, I think we're trying to grab, you know, I think that our presentation style tends towards trying to get people's attention and just to, you know, to use the tricks of kind of design, which, you know, not, you know, a lot of kind of, I think actually it's a kind of product of the fact there is so much self-publishing and so many kind of art directors and editors kind of create the content and have a very kind of intimate relationship with the content, that now magazine design is kind of quite stripped back and quite minimal and austere. And because I don't have the same sort of relationship with the kind of the content, it's kind of commissioned by someone else. I don't often, and we use kind of pickup images, and we kind of, you know, the photography that we use is it was not made by us. That I have a far kind of less close, you know, my relationship with it isn't as close, and so I feel I can kind of mess around with it a little bit more and kind of. And we can be a bit more kind of expressive with the design.
Now, I've got, I think this is this current issue.
Yeah, well, you've got the UK edition.
This is the UK. Well, so, yeah, so interesting. How many different covers do you do?
Well, we only do a max with two.
So you do a UK one and a US one.
Well, we're distributed in Asia, Europe, and America, and so we will take. I mean, it would generally, I think, sort of, you know, two out of three, the cover will be the same all over the world.
So this is the Thatcher one, and it says, "What she got wrong," but that only came out in the UK market.
In Europe, yeah. Okay, so that was that was our kind of European
edition.
And
what do you know? Can you even remember what was this week is on the cover in the US?
Yeah, well, it's the how-to issue, which is in all honesty a lot better cover. So it's kind of, you know, a little bit annoyed that that's the one that. So,
but it's quite common in a week for you to do two or three different covers.
It's quite common to do two. We don't do two. We won't. We haven't so far done a kind of three, kind of one for Asia, one for Europe, one for the US. I mean, generally, if there's a story which is specifically about the US story, we sort of assume that people in Europe and America aren't as interested in that as the kind of the domestic audience. So,
and I mean this as a compliment, but that cover probably cost you about $100, didn't it?
Yeah, I think it was very cheap.
So it's an archive picture and just great use of text. And that's often what you do. But what's interesting is that many of your covers are not, you know, they're not elaborate. It's the idea that sells them.
Well, again, I think that's just like my scrappy nature, really. And it's just, and we don't have very much time, and so I think we just kind of embrace the scrappiness rather than trying to kind of pretend that there has been this kind of an elaborate process. it is what it is. We're just honest.
Debbie, can I ask for your cover? You have Gillian Anderson on the cover. And the line underneath it is Gillian Anderson's Inner Life. Now, what's interesting is that everybody who does a women's magazine, they'll tell you orange, you know, Dago covers, you need red, you need, you know, bright lips. You've gone pale, grey, white. Why did you deliberately move away from all those traditional tricks of kind of like shifting a copy into a woman's hand?
Because I think we needed to look different enough that people would not confuse us with what was already out there. And actually on the newsstand, our distributors are not putting that with other women's interest titles. It's kind of nestled up actually near Monocle and kind of on that section, because we see it, the content sitting there more. And I think it's important to balance out, you know, to have something for women in that section as well as in the fashion section.
And then the layouts and things inside, again, just tell me, what were you trying to achieve with these? Did you feel, I often wonder about, you know, the attention span of people these days, you know, that, you know, I accuse other people. I know it's true for myself that my attention span is not what it used to be. We're all caught up in this mobile world. And although I will occasionally read, you know, 15,000 words in The New Yorker, there's not many days that I can afford to do that. And actually, once I start reading it after paragraph 50, my mind's on something else. Mm-hmm. Now, how long did you think your reads could be? What commitment did you think that people would give to an article?
Well, because it's a quarterly title, I think they would be willing to make that investment. And we could have, I think it's important to have those long reads in there because we're going for the audience who might read Vanity Fair or The New Yorker and enjoy those longer reads. So it's important to have at least a couple in there, I think. And in fact, I wish we'd had another longer essay in there.
Well, we're going to continue this conversation in a little moment, but you're listening to The Stack on Monocle 24.
Section D is the show you listen to for the untold stories, secrets and blazing headlines in the design sphere. The architects, fashion followers, artists and engineers who are making and breaking the trends across the world.
When Valentino touches the clothes, you see his hands tracing those lines of shape, form, and to see Valentino arranging one of his dresses is to understand the dress in terms of structure.
Join me, Hugo MacDonald, for an hour of insight, interviews and discussion every Tuesday at 1900 hours London time.
That's Section D with Hugo MacDonald, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
And welcome back to The Stack with me, Adjit Huck, and my guests Richard Turley and Debbie Evans. Richard, can I ask you, when you moved to New York from the UK, and you still seem like an Englishman to me, do you feel that there's a benefit to being an outsider in a fresh media market when you arrive? You know, that obviously lots of British people have gone to New York to work in the media industry and often in the world of fashion. But I wonder if there's something about being a little bit of an outsider when you're putting together your ideas that you see things a little bit differently to the other people around you, makes it a bit fresher.
Yeah. Yeah, I do. I mean, I can
come with you to job interviews, by the way, if you need someone to sell you.
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think also I didn't really, you know, when we were first launching the magazine, and I didn't really understand what Business Week was. I didn't really understand the heritage of it, and I think that was probably useful. You know, I wasn't trying to impress anybody in, and also I just didn't really know anybody out there. So it was kind of, there was a sort of degree of kind of independence that was, I think, was kind of quite useful. The thing is, you know, all those guys over there, all the kind of designers, they all look to Europe. I mean, all the magazines that they buy are the same ones that we've got on the table. These are all this, you know, but for some reason that kind of design just can't translate over there, or just doesn't translate over there into sort of into their magazines, or not in many magazines. You know, they're kind of locked into this, you know, quite a kind of, I don't know, the magazines don't necessarily reflect their influences, I think, really. And so I think what we did was kind of to do something which was kind of quite much more kind of European in feel, and I think that was what we did.
And Debbie, for you, you're an outsider as well, and you are someone with a tech background coming to women's magazines. Again, did you feel that there, you know, you've had a bit more freedom in a way that you're not brought up through the heritage of, you know, what's expected to be on page?
Definitely. I think genuinely all we were doing when we did the first issue was, what magazine do I want to read? And that was our only criteria. We weren't looking, well, obviously we looked at what other people were doing, but it was very much, you know, just the product we wanted to make.
And can I ask you, looking further back, you know, over the past few years, you know, not particularly what's on the news stand today, were there key magazines in your life growing up that you've, you know, we all have that moment where you know, when you're a teenager or when you're 20 as well, perhaps these days people don't, but when you cracked open the spine and you felt at home, this is me, this says something about me. Were there magazines that helped kind of define your life that you felt were really kind of brands that represented you?
When I was very, very young, because I've wanted to be a journalist since I was about 12 or 13. When you're a little girl, there's plenty of teenage magazines like Sugar and, you know, that do great things for teenage girls, or that teenage girls enjoy reading. I don't know if they do great things. That's definitely not correct. but actually, the reason I started this is because there was no magazine that made me feel at home, really. There was always a little something missing, and I thought that perhaps others might feel the same.
And for you, Richard, was there a kind of a journey through titles over time?
I've been obsessed with magazines since I can remember. I mean, for me, it started with music and... Melody Maker, actually. I was far more Melody Maker. And then I really love Q.
I love that, still that divide. Were you NME or were you Melody Maker?
Melody Maker, definitely Melody Maker. And then Q was really good for a while. And then, like, The Face. Sleaze Nation was a very big magazine for me. Dazed and Confused, obviously. Then New York Magazine, actually. I think after that, I think it kind of, there was a bit of a kind of a lull, and then New York came along, and I think that's still probably the best magazine, you know, if I had to. And I'm not supposed to say that. But.
No, I was going to say, but interesting, if there was a competition for the most creative covers, I guess New York Magazine and Bloomberg Business Week would be the titles that on that kind of weekly basis produce content that's really, really just amazing. I wanted to pick up one of your covers, which is one which I know that did win awards and did kind of grab people's attention. It was after the floods in New York, and it was an extraordinary, complicated image, but it just works so well. It's a flooded street, and the headline just says, "It's global warming, stupid." Now, how quickly does a cover like that come about?
that was kind of agonizing, if I'm being honest. Mostly me and Josh agree on pretty much everything. You know what, we have a kind of good hit rate of not falling out, but that one was one where I did have to kind of hold, you know, just sort of throw my toys out of the pram a little bit and just kind of say a lot on, you know, because I mean, I think he, you know, and you know, I think the nice thing about both of us actually is that we kind of, you know, we accept that we can be wrong sometimes.
And this idea didn't come out of anywhere. In fact, Mayor Bloomberg had also said that that there was a global warming element.
Yeah, no, well, that was just a slightly unfortunate, if anything, because that kind of because he really does not have no impact on the magazine in terms of the editorial, and he doesn't come into the office. He's very kind of careful about separating kind of, you know, his business from that. But so that was kind of afterwards. But I mean, that cover came out. Was just Josh came up with the line, "It's global warming, stupid." But I think he wanted to kind of downplay it a little bit or just make the picture bigger. And I was just trying to convince him that actually that is a really good line and we should make that as big as we can. And everyone's seen the pictures of the hurricane, you know, all the sandy pictures already. So,
what does a Richard Turley who's not getting his way look like? Do you go very quiet?
No,
just shout.
Grumpy, kind of sulk in the corner, very, very aggressively sulking.
An aggressive sulk is good, I think. They always work. Now, before we completely move away from reviewing the magazines, maybe you could just crack open one of these magazines in front of you. Is there anything inside in the world of art direction that kind of, you know, is it a daze or something, or is it, you know?
Well, for me, it's the best magazine designers in the world are MM Paris.
You haven't taken the plastic off that one. You were trying to take it home and give it to as a gift or something?
I was just running around like a madman trying to buy magazines. So I can't even go. But Purple Magazine.
Are you going to try and take it back to the news agent after
I'm
get your money back?
It's quite a good idea.
It's cling film wrapped.
The reason I like
stop people like you flicking your newsstand.
Well, I also to kind of protect the pornography from within. I just love it. I think it just celebrates. It's like all great magazines at the moment. It's a real celebration of print, and it kind of the pictures are great, the stories are great. You find out stuff in that magazine, you know, and it's, you know, it's that world that you kind of you're never really a part of, but you can buy into it and you get that little taste of kind of what it might be like, and that you're never really kind of, you know, you're never going to be exposed to it properly. But and that's what all kind of great magazines like Vanity Fair do all the time, and you know, Vogue are very good at doing it. But just, you know, this little sort of snapshot into this world, which, you know, I find very, you know, and I like, I mean, you know, and as I say, you find stuff out in that magazine. You know, that it's often now it's just we just regurgitate what we've seen on the internet or kind of, you know, or whatever these kind of stories, but real sort of this is, you know, the best pair of underpants from Sweden or something like that. It's valuable, you know. I mean, because anyone can kind of go into Bloomingdale's or wherever and just kind of pick up a pair of Calvin Klein's. But, you know, that sort of research.
Yeah. It's the art of service journalism. It's doing well for you.
A creative service journalism, you know. We just kind of peddle this crap out, don't we? You know, and kind of just, you know, I don't know, the general service kind of stuff with just no imagination and no flair. So, but yeah, I think that just goes back because people are just so scared of doing anything different that they might disrupt their fragile kind of magazine ecosystem. And so you just kind of pedal the middle line all the time.
And Debbie, you have a smaller team, but what does a Debbie that doesn't get her way look like?
I'm quite diplomatic.
Are you?
But then there comes a point where I just stop listening and just say no. Although there was some debate around the front cover actually using the circle, which is a brilliant idea by Jenny. And in the end, we just put it out to a trusted group of kind of influential media and non-media types who we thought were ideal readers and just got a vote.
Dangerous.
Consensus is always a bit worrying. Now, when you look inside a magazine, we're just talking a little bit about Bloomberg Business Week, and there is a kind of the energy that you might find on a web page almost brought into print. When you look inside any of these magazines, covers are of course great, but what is it inside that keeps you allured? Are you after the quietness of the long read and the white space, or are you after a kind of a more dynamic experience when you flick a page?
I think the quietness of the long read. There's actually another title I have here, which I didn't mention, called The Alpine Review, which is a beast of a thing. It was about €30, I think. I got it in Berlin. I think it's a Canadian publication, but I really like it because it's quite similar to Delayed Gratification in that it takes a kind of, I mean, observing the things that matter, this idea that you're stood at the top of a mountain, you're just taking a big picture view of everything, and there's lots of big ideas in there, and I think that is what print does really, really well.
And for you, Richard, when you look at your title, I think one of the most interesting things about the front cover is when you see it on someone's desk or when you see it, someone reading it on a plane, as you say, it is an advert for your brand. And we were talking a little bit earlier on, which you touched a really important thing, I think, which is about, you know, if you don't do magazines well, they won't sell. And great covers do encourage people to pick them up. You know, could you just tell me a little bit about how important you think it is that the magazine kind of says something about the person who's holding it?
Oh, it's fundamental. I mean, I think they do kind of define you in a way that you know, a device, you know, sort of in an iPad or something. Well, I guess that defines you as well.
Yeah, but the trouble is, and we talk about this, when somebody has a device on the subway, you haven't got a clue what they're looking
at.
So there's a missed opportunity for advertising your own brand, of course. But, you know, I think that's the romance of magazines, and there is a real romance, is that you look at somebody who's reading the same title as you, and you said, you know, were you an Enemy kind of guy, or were you a Melody Maker kind of guy? You know, you knew that each of those titles actually says something, you know, not only did you like music, there was a kind of music and a kind of take
Absolutely.
On the world.
Yeah, I missed that. I mean, the one kind of exception to that is the New Yorker. If you're talking about New York, I mean, that is still very proudly worn as a badge of honour on the subway, and people, I mean, to the extent of which I don't think people are actually reading it, they're just kind of holding it up and just saying, I do look at the, I'm slightly obsessive, and so I kind of look at, you know, their eyes are kind of darting around the room. They're not actually reading anything, but, you know, I'm sure they take it home and read it thoroughly afterwards. But kind of, you know, it's a very successful magazine in all sorts of different ways. But, you know, certainly they managed to kind of retain the kind of, you know, the element of pride that, you know, you have, and kind of wandering around the city with a copy in your back pocket.
And Debbie, if someone is spotted reading Libertine on the subway,
oh, hug them.
It is a lovely moment, though, isn't it? Because, I mean, like,
we have a tote bag that you get when you get a subscription, and I can't stop myself. You're on a plane, or you're at the beach, and someone's got
you,
and you're like, oh, I'm going to have to say hello.
the thing is, what I don't think American magazines or kind of like big magazines realise is this idea of a club. It's a, you know, you're buying into a kind of a way of thinking, and you're buying into this kind of club mentality. And, you know, you really need to kind of, I'm not going to use a terrible American word, leverage that. You need to kind of, you know, there is, and I think that, you know, without blowing too much smoke up your whatever, Monroe could do very, very well, is that there is this idea that there is a kind of it's a holistic kind of experience almost, that you do get enriched by the fact that you get a tote bag.
Yeah, and that's a really basic thing, where we have our emails after our names in the magazine, and if somebody writes you, we properly write back to every single reader.
Send them a tote bag.
Yeah, well, you send them a tote bag, or if something goes wrong with their subscription, they can phone you up, and you know, you'll say, oh, I'll go and get the person in the subscription department. It's not like some fulfilment out. So we try and make it feel like a bit club-like.
And you're kind of I mean, the magazines are kind of picking up on that, and we did a conference recently, and in the whole kind of conference thing seems to be kind of quite big as a way of kind of engaging your readers into making kind of that kind of a circular conversation, if you like. So the conversation doesn't just stop when you kind of pick up the magazine and when you read something on the website, or, you know, you enter a comment into a comment box on an article. So you're sort of seeing a little bit of that, but I think there should be a lot more of that. And, you know, I'm surprised that Condé Nast, for example, don't understand that a bit more. You know, the fact that, you know, these people are buying their magazines because they want to feel a bit special, that they want to feel part of this club. Mm. And it's just, and yet the kind of the experience that you get with those magazines is that it's kind of delivered in a kind of shitty sort of envelope that comes through, and there's no kind of sense of kind of mystery or luxury or kind of, you know, when this thing arrives, and
it's just
kind of they treat you so badly. It feels like.
Did you see what O'Cumley did with their last issue? They hand delivered them to subscribers, which is lovely.
A good message to send.
What? Probably a bit too many for Condé Nast.
And unfortunately, we have Monocle subscribers in a car ball and things, so going out on my bicycle, even if I set off now, it would probably take me a long time to get all those delivered. I must say this has been an amazing hour of conversation, and there's so many more things it would have been nice to talk to you about. I think we can have a group hug afterwards, because we all like each other's magazines, and I would certainly be pleased to be spotted with either of your titles on any subway. But that brings us to the end of edition 34 of The Stack. My guests today have been Debbie Evans and Richard Turley. Our producers were Dawn Trump and Adrian Craddock. If you have any comments or queries, then drop us a note at info@monocle.com. And remember, we're back next Saturday at 10 a.m. London time. And of course, you can always listen again via monocle.com or iTunes. So for now, from me, Andrew Tuck, it's goodbye and have a great weekend.